And today's last word in business comes from a man we know only as Tim. A couple of years ago, Tim heard about the bonuses that AIG executives received after being bailed out with government money. And in a fit of anger, he faxed a note to the White House headlined, "To Anyone with Common Sense." To his surprise, Tim received a letter, handwritten, from the President of the United States. It said, "I share your sentiments, and we are moving as quickly as we can to restore some common sense to the financial system." It's unclear whether common sense has been restored, but Tim thinks it makes common sense to sell the note, which is now on the block at an auction house in Miami. According to a press release, it is hoped that Mr. Obama's signature will sell for about $10,000. That's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. Now, in Hartford, Connecticut, highly performing schools get rewarded, while lesser performing schools get closed. But Hartford is also a district where parents get to choose their child's school. And the theory goes, parents will naturally choose good schools over bad ones. But as Jeff Cohen from member station WNPR reports, they often don't.
It's dismissal time outside Moreland School. Kids are throwing snowballs and eating cupcakes. Buses line up and move out. And Alfonso Castillo is walking to pick up his third grade girl. He was disappointed to hear that the school would probably close.
I have never had a problem with this school, and I'd be really disappointed they close it. I don't think this should be the one of the schools that should be closing.
My name is Marisha Simpson. I'm PTO president at Moreland, and I have four kids here.
Late last year, Simpson, Castillo, and other parents learned that Moreland was going to be redesigned. That means that the building will stay the same, but everything else will change. All of Moreland's teachers and administrators will be fired and will have to reapply for their jobs. Its old curriculum will be tossed, and a new school will open. It will be called the Expeditionary Learning Academy at Moreland School. The reason? The school's test scores were too low. But Simpson says that what she wants is for the district to improve Moreland, not reorganize it.
If they could just help out with the school that they're in their neighborhood, wouldn't that be better?
What makes this school good for you? Is it
the teachers and the way that they teach.
Even if the numbers aren't good?
Even if the numbers aren't great, they're learning, they're improving.
Hartford is a poor city in a wealthy state, and its students have historically lagged far behind their suburban peers. It's also a city 5 years into a major school reform effort that allows parents to choose which city school their child attends. The reform has led to closing nearly two dozen underperforming city schools. Christina Kishimoto is the city's assistant superintendent for secondary schools. She says Moreland has been underperforming for years by federal standards.
We had already given them a year leeway because they had made progress. So we wanted to see if they could sustain that progress. The progress wasn't sustained.
Tell that to PTO President Maisha Simpson. She points out that some of Moreland's numbers were just barely off the mark, and she doesn't want her children to go anywhere else.
I love the schools. I love the teachers. I love the way they teach. I love the way they solve their problems. I love the way they handle things.
Sarah Yatsko knows this sentiment well. She's a researcher from the Center on Reinventing Public Education at the University of Washington and has studied Hartford school reform. At a presentation to the Board of Education earlier this year, Yatsko said that Hartford parents don't always choose the schools the district wants them to.
We saw some schools that were low performing, yet very, very high parent satisfaction rates. That's something that the district should pay attention to and question and wonder about. Because if this model really is to work, you want parents to choose the schools that are the high performing schools.
Yatsko says that Hartford is far from unique. Parents across the country are slow to choose high performing schools over popular schools that don't make the grade. She says the job for districts like Hartford is to get more information out to parents because, the theory goes, good information makes for better school choices. And that's what people in Hartford are trying to do. The district has just hired an advertising consultant to woo city parents.
Do you want to be in medicine?
And a group of education advocates has built a website to help inform parents about their schools, giving them information from test scores to location to the school's racial makeup.
I choose.
We choose the Hartford Public Schools!
But as she walks her kids home, Maisha Simpson says that more information from the district might change the choices that some parents make, but it won't change hers.
This is where we live. We're going to be here for the rest of our lives.
For NPR News, I'm Jeff Cohen in Hartford.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. 1 year ago today, President Obama signed into law the most sweeping piece of social legislation in more than a generation.
Today, after all the votes have been tallied, health insurance reform becomes law in the United States of America.
But turning the health bill into law did not settle the debate. As NPR's Julie Rovner reports, it's merely changed the terms.
In case you've forgotten, the health law was intended to dramatically change the direction of the health care system. It will require nearly every American to have health insurance by the year 2014, but it will also provide substantial help for those who can't otherwise afford it. As the law's first anniversary approached, supporters like House Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi scheduled events to sing its praises.
With this landmark law, we made health insurance and health care a right, not a privilege, by extending coverage to 32 million more Americans.
Meanwhile, opponents like Utah Republican Senator Orrin Hatch here on the PBS NewsHour have been considerably more downbeat.
I hate to talk this way, but it's true. It is one of the worst pieces of legislation in the history of this country.
In fact, sowing seeds of doubt about the law is all part of opponents' strategy, says Michael Cannon, head of health policy for the Libertarian Cato Institute. That's because at the moment, with Democrats still in control of the Senate and presidency, opponents know they can't actually do much to change the law.
So if you want a legislative fix to Obamacare, if you want to repeal it, you have to keep it unpopular between now and January of 2013.
That's the soonest Republicans could gain enough control to make the law go away. So what needs to happen between now and then?
You try to keep the law from taking root, and you try to educate the public about all its harmful effects.
That's why all the defunding and repeal votes in Congress, not to mention the dozens of lawsuits challenging the law's constitutionality. Of course, if you're supporting the law, what you want is to sink those roots in so deep as to make the law, well, unrepealable. Cannon knows a little something about that, too.
You want to create constituencies that will fight to preserve it. And by sending $250 checks to seniors, you may be creating constituencies. By giving tax credits and subsidies to employers, you may be creating constituencies. And certainly, when the law begins spending hundreds of billions of dollars on health insurance subsidies to low and middle-income Americans, you're going to be creating a huge constituency.
And those are just a few of the law's benefits. Things like starting to fill in the Medicare prescription drug donut hole for seniors. Ron Pollack of Families USA, who does support the law, says that as the public sees more of the law's benefits, support for it will grow. But he says it's about more than just buying off individual constituencies. It's about what the law actually does for people.
Those people who've got pre-existing conditions, they don't want to be denied coverage by insurance companies. Those people who've got health conditions, they don't want to be charged an arm and a leg and discriminatory premiums. When people get sick, they don't want to lose the health coverage they've been paying for many years.
Pollack also says supporters of the law are still fighting to help the public understand the 2,000-page-plus measure.
There are so many myths about this legislation, from death panels, government takeover, that this is adding to the deficit. None of those things are true.
Health law opponent Cannon, meanwhile, is worried that many Republican governors who oppose the law are undercutting their arguments by working with the Obama administration to set up the new insurance marketplaces known as health exchanges.
Governors should not be taking the funds that are available under this law and not setting up those new government bureaucracies, because that further entrenches the law.
In other words, on the law's first birthday, it's still one big race, a competition between supporters who hope the health law will have many more birthdays to celebrate and opponents who'd like to blow out the candles permanently. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
Our sports commentator Frank DeFord has a few thoughts this week about football, basketball, and baseball, or rather he's passing on some thoughts from his friend.
My old friend, the sports curmudgeon, has been on hiatus for a while, just stewing in his own bile as he watches the idiotic graphics on ESPN grow and swell and get in the way of the picture. But he told me he figures if Tiki Barber thinks he can return to the NFL to play running back after 4 years, then the sports curmudgeon can come back and be crabby again. Hello, curmudgeon.
Hey, Frank. Can you believe the gall of almost all these National Football League teams? They lock out the players and then turn around and make the fans fork up big money months in advance for a season they're trying to ruin. What do these greedy NFL owners think? The football fans got concussions too?
And it's not just guys at the top of the NFL that my grouchy old pal is furious with. He's as mad at the President of the United States as Sarah Palin is.
Did you hear who the president picked for March Madness? Not only the top four seeds in the men's Final Four, but the four number ones in the women's too. Do we want a president who only picks the chalk? Just because he's numero uno himself, he picks all the hoop top dogs. Come on, leader of the free world, show me a little guts in your bracketology.
A point well made, Maestro Curmudgeon. Anything else eating at that sour sports disposition of yours?
Uncle Mo, can you believe it? I'll be a monkey's uncle if the huge favorite for the Kentucky Derby, for the whole Triple Crown, isn't a nag they named Uncle Mo. Man of War, Whirlaway, Citation, Secretariat, Affirmed. Now those are champions' names. Whatever happened to class, Frankie? Jeez, Uncle Mo. And speaking of class, there just happens to be a baseball team in Sendai, Japan. The Golden Eagles. Their stadium was terribly damaged from the earthquake. Wouldn't you think some of them lugnuts who run American baseball would bring the Golden Eagles and their opponents over to the United States when the Japanese season starts, play some games over here, and raise money to help the Japanese? Wouldn't you think they could just once stop that national pastime stuff and help the international pastime?
Sometimes even a sports curmudgeon can find a sweet idea. Let's bring the Sendai Golden Eagles to play in the United States next month. Arigato, Kamaji. Arigato.
Some comments channeled by Frank DeFord, who joins us each Wednesday.